I told Judge Van Bocklin and Judge Sykes maybe we ought to do this regularly. Shifts off. All right, we're ready for the fifth case this morning, and that's U.S. versus Sanchez.
May it please the Court. Your Honors, my name is Joyce Chen, and I represent Saul Sanchez. In the three-day trial below, the District Court permitted the government to spend the first 2 days proving the existence of a drug case, which the District Court later found had nothing to do with my client, even by a preponderance standard. As a result, the jury convicted Mr. Sanchez for conspiracy to retaliate against a witness.
On that one point, the judge found that in the sentencing dialogue, not in the trial itself. I think the trial itself said that the evidence was overwhelming.
The context, Your Honor, is correct. It was a sentencing context. However, the findings that he made were with respect to the evidence about the Vasquez-Jimenez drug conspiracy and that connection to my client. As a result, the jury convicted Mr. Sanchez for conspiracy to retaliate against a witness, even though there was no evidence that he even knew the alleged victims had been witnesses. As a result, I'd like to confine my arguments today to the three made in the briefs.
You can approach it however you like, counsel. It's your case.
Okay. One, there was insufficient evidence that Mr. Sanchez conspired to retaliate against a witness. Two, the district court abused its discretion in admitting voluminous and unfairly prejudicial evidence about the Vasquez-Jimenez drug conspiracy. And three, the district court clearly erred in enhancing Mr. Sanchez's offense level for attempt by three. As your honors know, conspiracy to retaliate against a witness is a specialized conspiracy statute. It requires the government to show that Mr. Sanchez knew that the alleged victims had testified against Mr. Vasquez and that he conspired to retaliate against them because of that testimony. All the government has shown is that Mr. Sanchez knew the alleged victims had owed Mr. Vasquez a debt. Knowledge of a debt is not equivalent to knowledge of prior testimony. The government points to only two reasons why this court should uphold this conviction. One, defense counsel at closing said inside knowledge about that case was known everywhere, but closing statements are not evidence. Two, the government says perhaps other people might have told Mr. Sanchez about the testimony. But while this is possible, mere speculation does not rise to beyond a reasonable doubt. Without being able to show knowledge, the government is unable to show any intent that Mr. Sanchez had.
Other than the direct, what was that, other than the inference evidence, what was the direct evidence that Mr. Sanchez knew about the testifying at trial?
There was nothing, Your Honor, nothing. All he said was, these people owe Mr. Vasquez some debt. No reference to testimony, witnesses, the conviction, the trial of Mr. Vasquez, nothing. If this court reverses for Mr. Sanchez's conviction for conspiracy to retaliate, it should also remand for resentencing because, as this court has recognized in Colon and Manzella, the defendant is entitled to resentencing even though he has concurrent sentences because the district court may have imposed heavier sentences on other counts, in this case 218 months, erroneously believing that Mr. Sanchez had been properly convicted of conspiracy to retaliate, for which he received 120 months. So why did the jury convict Mr. Sanchez for conspiracy to retaliate against witnesses when there was no evidence he had the requisite knowledge or intent? It is because the jury was unfairly prejudiced. The district court abused its discretion in admitting voluminous and unfairly prejudicial evidence about the Vasquez-Jimenez drug conspiracy. This case stands out among others involving prejudice appeals for two reasons. One, the government spent the majority of Mr. Sanchez's three-day trial questioning 5 out of 7 witnesses almost exclusively about the 2005 Vasquez-Jimenez case, which, two, the district court at sentencing found had no connection to my client, even by preponderance standard.
Well, that was for purposes of the relevant conduct analysis, right?
In the context of
but for purposes of the motive for the charged offenses, I think my understanding is that that's why this otherwise unrelated drug dealing evidence was admitted because it provided the context for the indebtedness, which was the motive for the kidnapping.
Right. That's why the district court let it in, motive and background. However, in the sentencing context, he said, I don't understand why Mr. Sanchez did what he did. He said he still saw no connection between all of this drug conspiracy evidence and Mr. Sanchez's conduct. It was in the sentencing context, and perhaps the district court realized it too late, but he was talking about all the evidence he let in and why he let it in and what Mr. Sanchez actually did, and he saw no connection even by
the judge gave three limiting instructions with regard to that evidence, didn't he?
Yes, he did. But if there were, and most limiting instructions are effective, Your Honors, but if there was ever a case where they're insufficient, it is this case, where the first two-thirds of the trial was spent on questioning a majority of witnesses about a 2005 drug case, which the district court later found had no connection by preponderance. And perhaps what makes this case most revealing is the district court's own acknowledgments at trial. He said on day one, that the government's extensive presentation of the nuances that surrounded the sting operation for the Vasquez-Jimenez case was sort of on the edge of a foundational presentation for a drug prosecution, which invites the confusion, the unfair prejudice, and the misleading possibilities counsel is complaining of. And on day two, he said, there's a possibility that the previous drug case could unfairly prejudice this jury or confuse these issues in their mind. And the reason he said that was because nearly all of the evidence admitted in the 2005 case was admitted here. Photographs of the cocaine, photographs of the stash house FBI busted, photographs of the drug runners associated with Mr. Vasquez, wiretapped recordings, video recordings, even wiretapped conversations were read aloud between the drug runners at Mr. Sanchez's trial.
Did Mr. Vasquez object to the evidence when it was admitted? I know that he had an issue with the Santiago proffer. The trial itself, when the evidence is being admitted, did he actually object to the evidence itself being admitted to trial?
Yes, Your Honor. Several times he made, up until the fourth witness testified, he also objected. He made several statements about how the FBI agent who testified first should make sure that the wiretap conversation she was referring to was Mr. Vasquez's in 2005, not anything to do with Mr. Sanchez. Also, co-counsel objected right after opening statements, and the court definitely had the opportunity to decide because from the beginning, after the opening statements, he told the government to draft this limiting instruction, which...
Right, but the evidence itself is, and I may be wrong when I'm my memory, but as I recall, the evidence itself, except for maybe an objection somewhere along the line by a co-defendant, the evidence itself came in or started coming with no objection at all from Mr. Sanchez. Am I correct on that?
There may have been
later objections, but not there were not objections as the evidence started coming in.
What happened was, you're right, in the Santiago proffer before the trial he objected, but then also after opening statements, co-counsel objected, and he joined in every time the court had a sidebar or sua sponte called a sidebar. And both at all times, the court referred to both Mr. Sanchez's counsel and co-counsel. There was no dispute as to whether the objections also applied to him or not. The court just assumed that it did and addressed both counsels at all times with regards to the prejudicial effect of the evidence.
I'd like to talk about the attempt offense here, the attempted kidnapping.
Sure.
And its relationship to the conspiracy to kidnap offense that was also charged in this case.
Yes.
As I understand it, our circuit defines attempt as requiring that the defendant have the intent to commit the base crime and that he engage in conduct which constitutes a substantial step toward the commission of that crime. And that's it. Is that a fair statement of our circuit law?
Yes.
And other circuits have a little bit more refined definition that requires the intent to commit the crime, a direct act in the course of conduct that would culminate in the commission of the crime, and that that act have be substantial and that it was strongly corroborative of the defendant's criminal purpose, all of which tracks the model penal code. But then also a fourth requirement, that the act falls short of the commission of the crime, the intended crime, due to intervening circumstances. I think that's the definition of attempt that's used in a majority of states that actually have statutes that define that crime. And that saves the attempt version of the offense from being a lesser included offense of the conspiracy. And I know none of this was brief, but it just occurred to me that the way our circuit defines attempt puts an attempt charge that's brought along with a completed conspiracy charge at risk of being multiplicitous. In other words, because the attempt becomes a lesser included offense of the conspiracy, because I don't see any distinction in the elements of attempt. They all seem to be nesting within the conspiracy offense. I know that I'm springing this on you without any preparation, but you know if we have any case law addressing that question?
Well, so besides intent, the Seventh Circuit has defined attempt based on the substantial step test. And, you know, as you stated, it's derived from the Model Penal Code, which requires basically the district court to find that there was some minimal level of conduct. So there needs to be conduct that, independent of any intent, shows some firmness of criminal purpose. And we argue that even if Your Honors decide he did conspire to kidnap and did have the intent, still there was no substantial step. Because if you look at the conduct alone, well, there's really just one, but that alone is not strongly corroborative of a criminal purpose. So even under the Seventh Circuit test...
What conduct is that you think it doesn't show a criminal purpose?
Where he went to the garage set up by the FBI and looked at this car, this unusable car. The government contends that he also went to Mexico, talked to these alleged cartel members, secured a house. But if you look at the language in the transcripts, in the recorded conversations, it is ambiguous at best whether he had a house, whether he even went to Mexico, whether he talked to anyone there.
Well, even if it's ambiguous, though, if you can draw a conclusion from it against him in favor of the prosecution, I think that doesn't that stand?
It's not just ambiguous, though. The evidence is conflicting. For example, with regards to the house, the day before he was arrested, he told an acquaintance on the phone, "What I need is cash to rent a house." But then a few hours later, the next morning, he told the cooperating witness, "This is what's going to happen. They're going to lend me a ranch." But this is all in future tense. And attempt is about conduct. It's not just about planning. And the whole goal is to avoid convicting people based on thought crimes. And given that the day before he said he still needed a house, it's ambiguous at best whether he actually did anything to secure a house. And as far as whether he went to Mexico, the cell phone records don't even support that. He only went as far as Texas. And what he says about these alleged cartel members, according to the government, is that what happens is that I get together here with some guys. They're going to take care of something with the leap that we have to take. Again, it's a future tense. There's no indication of whether he actually met with these persons. So the only conduct there really was him going to this garage to look at the car right before his arrest.
What do you ascribe the trip through several states down to Texas? What's that for?
The jury didn't know this because it was revealed at sidebar, Your Honor, but of the about 300 wiretapped conversations the FBI recorded over 2 weeks, 97% of the calls were about drugs.
But wasn't there testimony that he, in fact, had made contact with people in Mexico about a certain area of Mexico to which they could take these people once he dropped them off at the border?
That evidence came in as a wiretap recording. That's what Mr. Sanchez said. He said, "I'm going to take them to this region in Mexico. People are going to take them from there." But there's no indication that anything went beyond the planning stage and became a substantial step. This case is really about my client, who bragged about his connections with Mr. Vasquez, which the FBI found no contact or communication between my client and Mr. Vasquez, and about these plans my client had, which never substantiated into any conduct whatsoever.
But as the court noted, however, that doesn't mean that other people on behalf of Mr. Vasquez could not have been in contact with your client.
That's true. It is possible. But the record shows nothing indicating that, just like the government's contention that other people might have told Mr. Sanchez that these alleged victims that he was going to kidnap had been witnesses. But there's nothing in the record, and it's just mere speculation. I'd like to reserve my time for rebuttal.
You're out of time, counsel.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
I'll give you a minute for rebuttal.
So I discussed...
Well, you can use it when you come back for rebuttal.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
May it please the Court. Jeff Perconti on behalf of the United States. With respect to the sufficiency of the evidence argument, I'm going to start with the third count of the indictment, which was the retaliation count. The evidence on that count was that in multiple conversations, the defendant told the CW that he had been in contact with Mr. Vasquez. He bragged about it in I believe, four of the conversations, including the initial conversation when he mentions that the reason he's going to carry out this kidnapping is because these two individuals owe the defendant a drug debt. That drug debt was the same that was the testimony that these two individuals, Ignacio Vega and Maria Jimenez, gave during a trial of Mr. Vasquez.
But he doesn't talk anything about them testifying, does he?
He never explicitly mentions testifying, Your Honor, but the jury could have easily drawn the inference that if Mr. Vasquez is talking to the defendant, he has sent him to see the CW, who Mr. Vasquez and the CW have a history together. Mr. Vasquez helped the CW get multiple jobs. They had known each other since 1995. The CW had run a car wash on behalf of the defendant for about 4 months. This is all in the CW's testimony. The idea that Mr. Vasquez sent the defendant to go and talk to this individual, and that when they arrived to see the defendant on October 10, 2006, the defendant knew about this drug debt, that the jury could have inferred from that Mr. Vasquez is talking to him about this drug debt. He's also going to mention, by the way, the reason I'm going to spend the bulk of the rest of my life in prison is because these two testified against me.
But that's a leap. There's no mention about testifying, no mention about a trial, right?
Well, the two victims, the planned victims, both testified that they testified at the trial.
Right, but we don't have anything to indicate that this defendant, Mr. Sanchez, knew about that.
Well, it's circumstantial evidence. There's no...
There isn't circumstantial evidence either. There isn't any evidence.
Well, Judge, I think this court has instructed that the juries can bring their common sense into the equation.
But not speculate.
Well, I don't think they're speculating when... Oh,
yeah, they can't speculate about what he knew. They can make inferences, but only if there's an evidentiary basis for the inference, and there isn't here.
Well, Judge, I think the evidentiary inferences are that on multiple occasions, the defendant said, I talked to Mr. Vasquez. He raised this debt both in the first conversation on the 10th and the last one on the 24th.
Right. There's plenty of evidence to support the motive for the kidnapping being a drug debt owed to Vasquez, but there isn't any evidence to support an inference that the motive for the crime was retaliation for testimony, because he didn't know that these were witnesses who testified against Vasquez.
Well, Judge, it's a common sense inference. It's that if he's talking to Mr. Vasquez and Mr. Vasquez is sitting in jail for the next 30 years of his life and he's talking to him about these two individuals, I think that it's common sense that Mr. Vasquez is going to say, these folks, you know, are the reason why I'm here. I mean, they were one of the...
There's nothing even close to that. They owed him $2,500 or $25,000. That's... And I'm reading from what... the government, from your brief, when they're talking about what the how he knew them, and it doesn't say anything about a trial or testimony.
Well, Judge, there's no, I don't think there's any, there's no reason for the defendant to lay out all the reasons to the CW why he's there. I think it's enough that he says that he identifies, he's identifying information about the two victims, says repeatedly that he's doing this on Mr. Vasquez's behalf. brags repeatedly that he's been talking to Mr. Vasquez, and Mr. Vasquez sent him to see the CW.
You can talk about that all you want, but no trial or testimony is mentioned. You've got him on a conspiracy to kidnap. A conspiracy to retaliate against a witness when no mention of the fact that he was a witness in any evidence that you have.
And that's correct, Judge. There's no direct evidence that he ever said that a CW, I know these guys testified against Mr. Vasquez, but the circumstances of the multiple conversations where he says that he talked to him, the information that he had when he went to see him, and the fact that Vasquez sent him to see this individual, all taken together, the jury, it's a common sense inference that Mr. Vasquez would have mentioned, or somebody else. He also talks about going down to see cartel members. He's involved with a lot of people, both Mr. Vasquez himself and associates of Mr. Vasquez, and the jury could draw the inference that it's likely that one of these folks mentioned this to him. He knew about this debt. This debt was the substance of their testimony at trial, and so it's a common sense inference that somebody mentioned this to him as they were describing this debt to him that sent him on this mission to kidnap these two individuals. But if the court finds that there's insufficient evidence on this retaliation count, the court need not remand for resentencing. As laid out in our brief, it's harmless error at the district court. If the court concludes it was error, it's harmless.
He got an above-guideline sentence, didn't he?
He did not, Judge. He got the guideline range was 188 months to 235 months. He was sentenced to 218 months. That's what's in the judgment. In the sentencing transcript, it says 280 months, but it's very clear, based on the court's discussion, that he sets out the guideline range. He said he's sentencing the defendant within the guideline range. The guideline range is 188 to 235. He gives him 218, which is around the midpoint of the guideline range. He describes why he's doing that, and that is this defendant had been convicted of a serious drug offense in the past and committed the instant offenses while he was on supervised release. He also talked about the nature of the evidence that he heard at trial, and that it was chilling about what would have happened to these folks, that they were going to be kidnapped, taken to Mexico, and the judge said probably killed, which is the reality of the situation.
But do you know with any degree of certainty that had the judge not been found guilty of the retaliation, that the judge could have sent him somewhere else within the guideline range, like lower in the guideline range? I mean, what effect that the retaliation conviction had in the sentence and the other two charges as part of relevant conduct?
Well, Judge, the 120-month sentence that was imposed on the retaliation count, there's obviously for grouping purposes for the guidelines, that count didn't play any role whatsoever. None of the parties mentioned it in their sentencing memoranda or in front of the court when they were talking about 3553A factors. The court never mentioned it. The court was focused on this defendant has been convicted of a serious drug offense in the past. He did this on supervised release. And the evidence I heard at trial was very chilling, essentially what the court says, that these folks were going to be kidnapped, they're going to be taken to Mexico, and in the court's opinion, likely killed. And so the district court didn't provide any indication that it was relying on the retaliation itself, that these were witnesses that were targeted. That's never mentioned by either the parties or the district court at sentencing.
That, of course, makes the crime qualitatively more serious.
Judge, I think that's – I would agree with that, but that doesn't take away from the fact that the district court didn't consider it at sentencing. It just wasn't – it wasn't an issue or raised by anybody at sentencing. And for that, the fact that he sentenced the defendant near the middle or
– I'm going to interrupt. Do you know the answer to the attempt question that I asked earlier, why our definition of attempt in this circuit is not at least susceptible to a multiplicity analysis as against the conspiracy to kidnap offense in the circumstances here?
Sorry, Judge, I didn't mean to interrupt. I frankly, I haven't researched it much, so this may be slightly out of turn, but I believe that an overt act is just something that's done in furtherance of the conspiracy, whereas a substantial step is something more. It confirms the intent to commit the crime, and for that reason, I think a substantial step, where every substantial step may be an overt act, not every overt act would be a substantial step. And it's this idea of confirming the intent to commit the offense, which clearly happened here on October 24th when the CW, when they're viewing the vehicle and the CW asks the defendant, is this what you need? And the defendant says, more or less. And then he says, how many persons are you going to put in there? And he says, two. And so here, I mean, that going there, viewing
that. I don't think there's any question that he possessed the requisite intent here. The question is whether his conduct, what he actually did, amounted to preparation or planning or an actual attempt to commit the crime. And as attempt is understood in most other jurisdictions, it's got to be a lot more than it seems to me is present here. He didn't even have the names of these victims, right? We don't know if he knew how to find them, where to find them, what he was going to do to abduct them. I mean, there's plenty of intent evidence. The problem is there's not much conduct.
Well, Your Honor, I think on the victim identification issue, he told the CW that these are two individuals, one whose first name was Yolanda, who owned a restaurant at 31st and Lawndale. Ignacio Vega is not named Yolanda, obviously, but he owns a restaurant named Yolanda that's at 31st and Lawndale. The second identification of the victim was that the person had the last name Jimenez, and obviously the second victim here, his name is Maria Jimenez. And so as far as not knowing who the victims are and not this other information, when you consider that there's really no reason for the defendant to give the CW any identification information about the victims. The fact that he gave him this much indicates that it's a reasonable
inference. What about the conduct question, though? All that goes to his intent. What about the conduct question? He wasn't even close to committing this crime.
Well, Your Honor, I think on the conduct, it's clear that he traveled to Mexico. He says it himself. In the October 18th call, he says, I went and talked to cartel members in Mexico. He doesn't say it as clearly as I'm saying it, obviously, but with the interpretation of the CW of the transcript, as well as what the defendant said on the transcript, before he goes, he says, I'm going to go see some of these cartel members and see if they'll help me. After he goes, on October 18th, he says, I've talked to them. They're going to help me make the jump. They're going to take these people and help me make the jump. So they're going to help him out. That's a substantial step. He wants to commit this offense. He has taken that confirms his intent to commit this offense, that he drove down to Mexico, drove back, and met with these folks who said they're going to help him. It's a substantial step that the CW says, I'm going to show you a car. I have a car for you. He says, great, I'll come see it. He goes to this garage. He looks at the vehicle. He says while he's there, not only this is what I need, not only that I'm going to put two folks in here, and he talks all about his plan. He's going to drive them to Mexico. He's going to put them in a house in Joliet that he says he's obtained with some buddies, that they're going to lend him this ranch, which indicates that he's done something else and then has obtained a ranch. And the district court could rely on the defendant's statement, and the jury could as well, when considering whether he had made a substantial step. And so there's multiple indications here that there's conduct involved. He shows up at that garage. He tells the CW all about his plan. And then the CW says, okay, I'll go get the keys. And the defendant says, well, I'll pick him up on Friday, essentially. And so there's conduct there. It's not just discussions. Which I know a recent case from this circuit has held, that the Galish case, where all they had were discussions, it was a solicitation case. That's not this case. It's more than just discussions. There's conduct here of at least three different ways: obtaining the house, driving to Mexico, going to the October 24th, 2006 meeting.
Let's assume it's enough to sustain the conviction. What about the guidelines application here? He's entitled to a decrease of 3 levels for an attempt unless he has completed all the acts he believed necessary for successful completion of the substantive offense. So he has to have completed a kidnapping.
Well,
right?
Or he was
circumstances
about
demonstrate that he was about to, but for his apprehension, and we're clearly not there.
Well, the district court held, and it's a clear error standard, the district court held that he was about to complete all acts, he would have completed all the acts, but for his being arrested.
He wasn't even close. The evidence doesn't support that.
Well, Judge, there's this issue with the money, but he repeatedly said, I need a car and I need a house.
And license plates, well, and keys, and, a plan for carrying out the abduction and the location of the victims.
Well, Judge, I think on the car, he says repeatedly, I need a car. That's what he says. I need a car, I need a car, I need a car. He has a car. He says repeatedly that he needs a house, and he gives it. The district court could have relied on his statements that he makes multiple times at CW, I have a house. He says that they need license plates. And on October 24th, in that conversation, Mr. Garza, the defendant's co-conspirator, says, I've made arrangements with my buddy, and we're going to have license plates in a week and a half. Now, I understand that we're not going to have license plates tomorrow, but the fact is the arrangements have been made. And
well, what degree of imminence is responsible or is required here to make this three-level decrease inapplicable? Because that's what we're talking about here.
Judge, I think
an exception to a decrease he's otherwise entitled to, right?
I don't think there's a bright-line rule. I think this is a clear error standard, so the district court has some flexibility. But I cited the Brown case, and I realize it's from the Eighth Circuit, but in that case, it was conspiracy to possess an incendiary device, and the incendiary device was going to be a spark plug and a wire. Neither of the co-conspirators had the spark plug or the wire at the time that the defendant was arrested. But the court held they would have easily obtained these things. Here, it's the same thing. He said he needed a car. He said he needed a house. He had them both. He needed the license plates, and Garza says we've made the arrangements to get the license plates. The other, he never says I need other instrumentalities. He never says I need a plan. He lays out his plan to the CW. The instrumentalities, tape, rope, whatever, he never says he needs it. But even so, we can go to True Value and buy that. That's a minor thing, which, as the Brown court said, and I see him out of time, if I finish this thought.
Is there any evidence that he had a gun or other weapon or means of coercing the victims to come with him in the car?
There is no evidence that he had a gun or any other weapon, nor that he believed that he needed those two items.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll give you 2 minutes for your rebuttal.
I'm sorry I'm unable to answer the lesser included. If Your Honor would like, I can write a brief and submit it to the court after.
I was just curious.
With regards to the sufficiency for attempt, it's not conduct alone that is sufficient. It's conduct that is strongly corroborative of a firmness of criminal purpose. Like I said, all the statements were in future tense, no evidence that he had actually done anything. And as for the car, like Your Honors point out, there was no key. He never asked for one. He just left the garage and was arrested. The license plate would have taken at least 1 week. And for the resentencing, if this court vacates the conspiracy to retaliate, all this court has held is as long as the concurrent sentences were higher, that alone entitles the defendant to resentencing. And here, it was 218 months for the other two, and then for conspiracy to retaliate, it was 120 months. With respect to the prejudice, if I wasn't clear enough, there are two examples of why Mr. Sanchez had been tarred by association. One, he was convicted for conspiracy to retaliate, even though there was no evidence that he had the requisite knowledge or intent. And two, which is something that I just talked about, which is the attempt. Those three limiting instructions weren't sufficient to erase the prejudice from the jury's mind. In fact, no number of limiting instructions would have been sufficient. And as for sentencing, it overlaps a lot with the attempt argument. But just to make clear, Mr. Sanchez didn't even know the correct names of the alleged victims. He called them Yolanda and Jimenez, which are not their correct names. He didn't know where they worked, where they lived. And so he couldn't recognize them or locate them. He didn't have any instrumentalities for kidnapping. None were found on his person or his co-defendants or their vehicles. He didn't have a plan. And as for the things that he explicitly said he needed, he didn't have the $25,000 in cash, and he didn't have a car, and he didn't have a house. So for those reasons, we ask this court to reverse on all the counts or at least remand for resentencing. Thank you.
Court, thank you, Ms. Jen, for your efforts on behalf of your client and also the Legal Aid Clinic of the University of Chicago.